Yeah, it's already illegal.
Okay. Is that right, sir?
Yeah, just like Senator read from the ordinance.
That's right.
Statute.
Are you able to prosecute? Do you have any of those cases in Portland?
We had a couple incidents in the city of Portland over the last 2 years involving Indo-Chinese refugees, some issues that had to do with religious sacrificing.
Yeah. You can prosecute under those statutes, though, the existing statutes, right?
Okay, we've adopted the amendment that Senator Gardner moved. Is there discussion on the bill? Senator Cohen.
I just want to make sure that we have we, as the bill is drafted, then do we allow the judge to not forfeit under any circumstances?
No.
It mandates it right now.
But it's
mandatory.
Only if they've been convicted of cruelty to animals, which I suspect is. You said you handled 10,000 cases in the last 6 years or something?
In the last 8 years.
How many of those have turned into a criminal prosecution with a guilty plea or a conviction? Or conviction
approximately 150 ended up going to trial. And of those, the conviction rate's quite high, which they are in most.
Well, 150 went to trial. How many would have been pled, though? How many would have been convictions?
Convictions? 95%.
I'm not making myself clear. When you go to trial, that's after the defendant has refused to plead guilty.
Correct.
Are there more than 150? Are there some that pled guilty rather than go to trial?
Yes.
Okay. Would you have an idea how many that would be?
Just a guess.
That's all right.
At least half of them would plead.
5,000 would plead?
No, half of those cases that actually go to trial are where there's been.
Oh, when you say go to trial, you mean prosecuted. There's 150 that have been prosecuted.
Correct.
Okay. And maybe half of those pled and half of them went to trial.
Approximately. That's just
an estimate.
So 150 resulted in criminal charges, is that?
Of those 10,000.
Okay. So that's, what is that, 1.5%?
1.5%. That's correct.
So this isn't going to happen very often.
The other option is to make it optional.
Other option to make it
doesn't
optional.
Doesn't make a lot of difference.
Doesn't make much difference to me.
You want to make it optional?
I'm certainly not going to vote for it the way it is now.
Okay, let's make it optional. Move, Mr. Chairman.
What, Senator Gardner?
Convicted of cruelty.
You'd only need subsection 1 if you just change that. You wouldn't need the rest of it.
Convicted of the may be required to forfeit. How about we said something like, counsel, if instead of shall, may be required to forfeit any rights in the animal?
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator,
My suggestion is that we redraft this thing to, number one, make it discretionary of the court in terms of forfeiture, and secondly, to include the as part of any sentence or judgment that the court may impose, the right to impose these costs we've been talking about. It would be a very short bill, but I think that could easily be done. And I think it'd be faster and easier than trying to tinker around with the one we've got here.
Well, wouldn't we have? I hear what you're saying. We don't need subsections 2 and 3 of sections 1. But what about the suggestion that Senator Gardner just made as to how we would word subsection 1, which would then just become section 1?
Yeah, well, the thought in subsection 1 is what I think we want to retain, but it looks to me like we're going to have to reword it. It just kind of hangs out there. It contains the thought, but it's hanging out there is what I'm getting at.
That's right.
It's just awkward language, because really you want to verse it in terms of what the court may order as opposed to what
the defendant shall lose.
Right? How about this? If counsel could work on that draft of that and then come back to that bill after the hearing on the next bill, and then we can pass it out. That'd be all right?
Yeah, I'll work on it, sure.
Just work on it right now.
Do that. Thank you very much. Now, Leo, we've got 4 more people signed up, but we're really going to have to go on. We've got 7 bills here today, and we're making a lot of progress on the bill. Yes, sir.
I'm one of those that have signed up to testify. Can I make one comment on the problems being addressed about the poor of the animals? My name is Greg Betts from the Humane Society of the Willamette Valley.
Okay. You want to make a remark about what we've been just talking about? Okay. You have submitted written testimony. So.
No, I haven't.
Well, I think you have. We've got something.
A letter from
you. Yes. Letter of support. My name is Greg Betts from the Humane Society of the Willamette Valley here in Salem. It's been my experience, too. I just wanted to emphasize what Officer Oswald said. The Humane Society receives a number of complaints, and those complaints are handled through assistance and through education. And only those cases that are truly aggravated, and where you're dealing with a person that is willfully either neglecting the animal or actually abusing the animal, would ever go to court. That has been our experience in the 5 years I've been here in Salem, that those people that are convicted of cruelty to animals are truly cruel to their animals, and in my opinion, have no right to keep that animal, because as Mike said, the recidivism is very, very high. The person has not proven themselves capable of caring for the animal. The animal goes back into that same situation where they are not cared for or neglected. So I very, very strongly urge the committee to keep the language to say that the animal shall be forfeited, because only those cases that do go to court are the ones that are really aggravated.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I guess he's afraid if we take the shall out in the rare case where there is a conviction and a fight, that the judge might end up backing off and giving the animal back. Okay. Larry Soa, are you going to be terribly disappointed if we go on? You see the bills coming out. We've got six more bills up.
Yeah.
Are you okay without testifying?
No, I want to testify.
Can you summarize it in about 1 minute?
Certainly. I'm Larry Soa from Milwaukee, Oregon, and I wasn't going to say anything until you got the extra testimony from the animal control people. And as most of you know, I'm a veterinarian from Milwaukee, and I've been called out by animal control people to look at animals and say, this animal was treated cruelly or this one wasn't. And I know in a couple of instances where I declined to say that the animal was treated cruelly, they went to another veterinarian and got his opinion and took their opinion and prosecuted the people. And so I think the judge needs to view each case on its own merits and decide whether the animal should be forfeited or not. I agree with the committee's
tendency to leave discretion with the judge.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. We'll close the hearing now. The other two witnesses that didn't get heard from sent a note up and said that if Greg Betts testified, that would be sufficient for them. So we're not leaving anyone too badly in the lurch. What is this?
She wants you to read that too.
Okay, we'll close the hearing now on Senate Bill 357 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 713. Senator Hendrickson.
Oh, it's pretty apart. It's exactly the same thing.
I understand that there's some overlap in these bills and that people are going to be testifying on more than one at a time?
Yes, these bills are related. This bill, for the record, I'm Margie Hendrickson, State Senator from District 20. Senate Bill 713 deals with the changing the definition of first-degree rape, and the Senate Bill 483 deals with crime of sexual abuse, and they are related in that we're in both bills, we're dealing with the enhancing the law in the sense of being able to deal with crimes in which there has not been consent to sexual intercourse. But right now, under the current law, for first-degree rape, forcible compulsion is the major element legal element in charging first-degree sex crime where the victim is over 12 and unrelated to the attacker. Senate Bill 713 modifies the law, defining the crimes of rape, sodomy, and sexual penetration. To recall, we passed the sexual penetration with a foreign object bill last session, and sex abuse in the first degree. The Oregon legislature has constantly examined and re-examined our code with respect to sex crimes to assure that Oregon citizens are adequately protected and the laws are reasonable and enforceable. Forcible compulsion is defined in the law as physical force that overcomes earnest resistance or threat, expressed or implied, that places a person in fear or of immediate or future death or serious physical injury to self or another, or in fear of immediate or future kidnapping. Sex crimes are the only crimes where the seriousness of the crime to be charged is judged by the actions of the victim. When we require a rape or a sodomy victim to meet their attacker with earnest resistance or to be in fear of death or serious injury or kidnapping, we are asking people to risk their lives to prove their injury to a prosecutor. This is the job of the state and not of the victim of the crime. As a result of the current law, the victim is often on trial for her action or his actions rather than the attacker, and district attorneys charging crimes must focus on and make judgments about the victim's role that properly belong to the jury. Senate Bill 713 expands and clarifies the circumstances under which a prosecutor should charge a suspected sex offender with first degree rape, sodomy, sexual penetration with a foreign object, or sex abuse. The bill creates a general scheme of aggravated offenses and applies it to first degree rape, sodomy, and sexual penetration with a foreign object and sex abuse. This scheme is simply that lack of consent by the victim plus one of the additional factors will give the elements for first degree rape. And those additional factors is if the attack occurs in the course of committing or attempting a burglary, kidnapping, robbery, or compelling prostitution, if it occurs with aid of another person, threatening or attempting to use a deadly or dangerous weapon, causing physical injury, intentionally attempting to place the victim in fear of death, serious injury, or kidnapping, and also adds, it doesn't remove the possibility of also having the earnest resistance, but it allows, as you'll notice, to have lack of consent without earnest resistance if you meet any of the other five above that. In addition, the bill preserves the current law where the victim is under 12 or under 16 and related to the attacker, and elevates incapable of consent by reason of mental defect, mental incapacitation, or helplessness from second-degree rape to a first-degree rape. The Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, which coordinates six women's crisis services, will testify about specific instances where the present first-degree rape law fell short of meeting its objective of protecting women from violent sexual crimes. Senate Bill 713 defines serious circumstances under which a charge of first-degree rape or sex crime, as discussed, is both appropriate and necessary to protect Oregonians. I ask your support for this bill. I believe Peter Sandrock, District Attorney from Benton County, is also here, and I think he is going to be also testifying on 483, which would allow presently some of these cases, which should be first-degree rape, but because of our present law are not able to be prosecuted, would allow them to be pleaded down to a lower offense but enhance that penalty. But that is in Senate Bill 483. So in that sense, the bills are related.
Question, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frey.
Page 1, line 20. Can you tell me what physical injury in that context is supposed to mean?
Okay, on page 1. Okay.
Just a minute.
I was going to say, physical injury has a general definition for purposes of the criminal code. I don't have the citation off the top of my head, but I can find it. Or maybe one of the district attorneys.
Yeah, I think I'd like to defer that to Pete Sandrock, if I might, because that is my belief, too, that that term is one that is used in other crimes, and I'd rather have him testify as to how they, in practice, define that term.
Okay, well, let's call on Pete Sandrock right now.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Pete Sandrock. I'm the Benton County District Attorney. In response to Senator Frye's particular question, physical injury is defined by statute in Chapter 161 as substantial pain or impairment of a physical condition.
It's 161.015, subsection 6. It's on page 201 of the...
We have, I think, a fair number of cases in which, under the current definition of rape in the first degree, that the victim may indicate that she is afraid of being beaten up, physically abused, but not in fear of serious physical injury, which essentially is life-endangering injury. It also is defined by statute. Under this scheme, if the victim is subjected to intercourse, deviant intercourse, or penetration with a foreign object, and is caused physical injury, and this is all against her consent, of course, that aggravates it to the first degree, a felony crime. If it would be helpful, I could go on and make some other general comments about 713 at this time.
Yes, please.
The essence of the 3A felonies that we have right now, rape one, sodomy one, and penetration with a foreign object, rely heavily, as Senator Hendrickson has indicated, on the definition of forcible compulsion, which is defined both by statute and by case law. It's a nebulous definition. It is difficult to apply for juries. It's difficult for victims because it does put a burden on them in terms of how they must react. I think 713 does a better job of defining and classifying the truly aggravated Class A felony crimes. It does not provide a total substitute for forcible compulsion, but it does provide some alternative definitions of aggravating factors that I think are somewhat easier for juries to deal with in the aggravated sexual assault. I hope that you have before you what I have entitled as an overview of the proposed elements of the 3A felony sexual offenses for Senate Bill 713 to try to describe for you a little bit better what 713 would do. The first element, of course, is going to be the occurrence of intercourse, deviant intercourse, or penetration of a foreign object. Those terms are currently defined by statute. Once you've proven that, then you have to prove either that the defendant did not consent to that sexual act, plus that that sexual act was committed during the commission of certain specified A and B felony crimes. For example, the burglary, the defendant who breaks into the house for the purpose of raping, rather than going into a further discussion of what degree of fear the victim happened to feel when this guy broke into her apartment, we're simply going to foreclose that and say that aggravating factor of that burglary, that entry into the dwelling in itself, is enough to aggravate the crime. Or if the lack of consent is coupled with the defendant's being aided by another person who is actually present, that essentially is borrowed from robbery in the second degree, which under the robbery statutes there is an acknowledgement that when the actor in the crime, when the defendant is aided by another person actually present, that that is an aggravating factor. Rape is not often accompanied by the assistance of another individual, but it is sometimes. It's in those sorts of circumstances, by the way, that in a strict rape case, how women have actually been convicted of rape by being the aider and abettor to a male who is raping another woman.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frye.
Is there some difference? There must be, I guess, because you changed the language, but you'll have to explain it to me. The distinction between forceful compulsion and failing to consent.
As it's mere lack of consent, if we were to prove, for example, that a victim were subjected to intercourse and it was without her consent, the correct verdict in that case would be sexual abuse in the second degree, a Class A misdemeanor. That the intercourse is a form of sexual contact, a term also defined by statute, but sexual abuse too, the A misdemeanor, is contact without consent. It's that anomaly, the drop all the way from the A felony when forcible compulsion is not proved, all the way down to the situation where it's just lack of consent that 483 would address. Forcible compulsion requires proof that the victim physically resisted to the best of her ability. Or in the alternative, that she was placed in fear of imminent serious physical injury, or that she or another person would be immediately or in the future kidnapped. That's a statutory definition.
That's the difference in the bill. That burden, you don't have to prove resistance or fear in order to get first degree
if
rape.
If I could add, I'd like to ask maybe if you could, I think that first degree rape or these sex crimes, this is the only area of the crime where the victim has to prove they physically resisted, isn't it?
I think so. Not having
the
not having the entire criminal code all stored in my mind. I think it's the only area where we're going to rely on the victim to provide an element of the offense for the offender, and that
a
is
a murder victim doesn't have to prove that he or she resisted.
No.
Or not a murder victim, but an assault victim.
Right.
Doesn't have to prove
right.
that. Right. That's a better analogy. That's a good analogy. Assault.
Or the state doesn't have to prove a murder
right.
victim.
Well, yes, but Mr. Chairman, I don't know. I think there are examples, though. The victim does have to prove, for example, in a fraud case, that he really relied upon the representation, doesn't he? That requires some proof by the victim that in order to establish fraud, the victim has to make a contribution to the state's case, I assume, in this situation.
Well, certainly would have to testify that the victim lost his or her money. Then we would have to focus on the actions and the intentions of the defendant solely.
But I really would like to have a better idea of what the words "does not consent" means. I mean, does that mean that the victim didn't say audibly, "I do not consent," or is silence going to be considered?
I can understand your problem with that, Senator. Right now, under sexual abuse in the second degree, which is ORS 163.415, one method by which that crime can occur is if the victim is subjected to sexual contact and the victim does not consent to the sexual contact. It is obviously a matter of proof. Some proof will be stronger than others. In my view, if that lack of consent is not communicated to the defendant, then no criminal act can occur unless the victim was incapable of consenting, and that's taken care of by another statute, by other statutory definitions.
Let me break in here just for a second. Behind Bill 483 in your bill book is the relevant statutes that have been reproduced.
So just a little easier to read than the small print.
For ease of reference, Senator Frye.
Well,
were you raising your hand, or
yes,
did you
I
scratch
was.
Your head?
I'm trying to frame this question so that I can see if I can get an answer here to this thing. Now you're saying that the language is subjected to forcible compulsion requires the victim's affirmative testimony that she resisted to the hilt, or where's that effect? Is that what you're saying? That's the law?
that or the, see, forcible compulsion, which is defined in ORS 163.305 sub 2, forcible compulsion means physical force that overcomes earnest resistance. The earnest resistance is the victim's role. She has to physically resist, or that there was a threat express or implied that places the victim in fear of immediate or future death or serious physical injury to self or another person, or in fear that the person or another person will immediately or in the future be kidnapped.
How do you prove that element does not consent? What do? You ask the victim, did you consent? And she says no. And then, is that it then?
No. I mean, presumably, we could put on a prima facie case in which the victim simply got on the stand and said, no, I did not consent. But obviously, the defendant, for due process reasons, would have to have been given notice that she did not consent. And then it becomes a question for the jury. Was there lack of consent? And did the, and since the defendant's intent has to go to each and every element of the crime, then he has to, there has to be proof that he was doing it knowing that it was without her consent.
All right. Now, I asked Senator Hendrickson earlier about the language on line 20 of page 1. So let me put this, let me rephrase this question this way. Suppose that there is intercourse with a willing woman who we'll say is a virgin at the time, who as a result of this intercourse suffers some physical injury. She never said, yes, I consent, but in fact, she voluntarily participated. She didn't say, I don't consent. So there you go, you've got a physical injury. You've got somebody who did not affirmatively say, I don't consent to this. And as a matter of fact, she did consent, but she didn't say anything one way or the other. So if she didn't say, I consent, then I'm wondering whether in those circumstances this person can be convicted of first-degree rape.
I'd like to respond to that. I think part of that, and I know Pete will probably have a response, would be the context of where, what else was happening in that transaction. I'm sure in terms of the matter of proof of what the situation was, you know. But you've said that the person did it voluntarily. So you're, in that case, it wouldn't be a crime because the person has consented to intercourse.
Well, that's really my question. She didn't say a word. Do you mean by the words "does not consent"? Do you mean to say that the female actually, unless she says "I consent," that the person could be convicted?
No, no. She does not have to say that I consent. There has to be a communication to the defendant that she does not consent, and the defendant has to reasonably understand that. It has to be part of the state's case, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that he knew she did not consent and proceeded anyway.
So it was forcible compulsion. That's what you'd be proving.
No, not necessarily. Suppose, for example, that the woman just thought, that he's going to beat me up. He's going to punch me in the nose. I don't want that to happen. She is, in that case, that means she is fearful of physical injury, but not serious physical injury. So that would not meet the definition of forcible compulsion. And therefore, under the current scheme, the state would have failed to prove that forcible compulsion existed.
Is forcible compulsion defined in here somewhere?
Yes.
163.305.
And I think I also understand the practical problems that you're concerned about. And I think that our experience with prosecutions under sex abuse in the second degree, where we are prosecuting someone for sexual contact, which is less than intercourse or deviant intercourse and so forth, but in which the the only other element is that the victim did not consent. First of all, we don't find victims coming in off the street complaining that I had a headache last night and I didn't consent. That, you know, we don't have the vindictive victim coming in to cause that sort of problem, and we really haven't had overwhelming problems proving lack of consent. It's all it is a factual issue. Now, in the state of Washington, they have had a rape in the third degree that is intercourse without consent, provided that the victim clearly communicate her lack of consent to the defendant.
Well, the changing mores we have now would say that it's the modern view that from what I understand from talking with people about this and some juries, that we don't commonly expect a woman to fight to the death as much as we used to. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that would generally be foolish for the victim.
Physical disabilities as a result of the attack, and it's very clear that she was totally and completely a victim.
And that's getting a 90% conviction rate.
Most rapes occur between people who know each other, over 50% of them. And that immediately introduces a note of suspicion in the minds of a lot of jurors. What I'm trying to say is, because so few rapes end up going to trial and ending in convictions, many women are very reluctant to report them at all. So the ones that do end up going to trial present a rather biased view of what rape is. And it does tend to be the ones that are strangers, where the women are very badly hurt. Women say things like, nothing will happen anyway, why should I report?
Maybe if I could, Senator Brown, if I could add something on that. In Lane County, I know I looked at the rape statistics in 75 before we changed the law. I think the rape statistics had, in terms of getting to the police department, getting through the police system, getting through the prosecutorial system, getting to trial, had only no place to go but up because they were such a small percentage that got through. My impression is that that has increased, that there, because of the changes in law, that we are getting a better flow through the system, but there's still a long way to go in terms of, and I guess I'm not so much concerned about I feel comfortable letting juries make decisions, but I feel the criminal law is our statement of policy of what the elements of first degree rape are, and then once you have, and that's what is our responsibility, not to determine what juries are going to do, but to determine what, as a policy matter, the elements of first degree rape are going to be. And I think the forcible compulsion, earnest resistance is another barrier, I think, in terms of getting prosecutions, in terms of what the prosecutor will decide they can get a conviction on, in terms of what maybe women are willing to come forward and talk about.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Okay.
We're going to have to go to Senator Brown. No one has signed up on Senate Bill 731. We want to have a hearing on it today. You want to?
I've got materials, and I can handle it in a couple minutes.
Okay.
2-3 minutes.
Would you go get Senator Meeker, Mrs. Meeker? We'll go to Senate Bill 410 in just a minute. Senator Brown wants to have a hearing on 731 here, though, first.
Excuse me. Dr. Frank from the Public Defender's Office.
Yeah.
You want to hear any opposition testimony an hour later on 713?
Rather later.
That's fine. I'll stick around.
Well, I'm not sure it'll be today, but we've got a couple more witnesses that can't come back if we don't hear them today that are for the bill, so we may not get to you today.
I'll wait for a while.
Okay, I'd appreciate it if you would wait. If we can get you on, we certainly will. Okay. Senator Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 791 is...
731.
I'm sorry, 731 is a copy of Senate Bill 626, which was before the committee in 1981. I've handed out to you some discussion of the problem of aggravated assaults on senior citizens from the source book of American state legislation in 1980.
Excuse me, go ahead. I am listening. I can listen to you and talk.
We're down to four and a half of those are gone, so I'll wait. Senate Bill 731, again, is simply a carbon copy of Senate Bill 626, which was before this committee in 1981, passed the Senate by a vote of 25-2 and floundered on the House floor, really because I did not get over there and lobby like I should have. It was carried by Senator Cohen. She did a good job, but we simply had a number of reservations on the bill. I guess maybe the major reservation is, should you provide a special penalty, for example, based upon the age of the victim? And if you look on the lines 20-22 of Senate Bill 731, you see, for example, that sexual abuse in the first degree picks out the victim who is less than 12 years of age. We have many laws in many states where the age of the victim is a determining factor, particularly where the victim needs special protection. I've just given you a copy of the testimony of Bill Perrin from last session. Bill was then the vice chairman of the Joint Legislative Committee of the Retired Teachers and the AARP. This session, he is the senior chairman of that committee. But as Bill points out in his next to last paragraph, seniors are generally less able to physically resist aggravated assaults. They're viewed oftentimes by the assailants as easy picking, particularly in the case of purse snatching. And even when we're just talking about either aggravated assaults or sexual assaults, for some reason in recent years, the victimization of seniors has been on the increase. Bill cites there in his third to last paragraph that a specialized study done in a number of major cities, one of which was Portland in the 70s, was funded by the LEAA, shows that aggravated assaults on seniors 65 years or over doubled, and rape of women 65 or older in Portland in the 70s tripled. Let's take a look and see how the bill basically operates from a structural standpoint. Line 5 indicates that assault in the first degree, and you can pretty well vision what would constitute assault in the first degree. It's an intentionally caused serious physical injury by means of a deadly or dangerous weapon. What this bill does is take assault in the second degree, which is a Class B felony, and turns it into a assault in the first degree and a Class A felony if the victim is 65 years or older. And so as a summary, the bill indicates where the victim is 65 years or older, this tends to elevate the degree of the offense and the level of the felony by one degree. Likewise, in Section 2, where you have assault in the third degree, which is situations where there are physical injuries or serious physical injuries, sometimes caused, sometimes not caused, with deadly or dangerous weapons. Down on line 17, we take essentially assault in the fourth degree, which is today Class A misdemeanor, and elevate it to assault in the third degree, which is a Class C felony, where the victim is 65 years or older.
Mr. Chairman,
I'd rather not take questions on this today, if it's okay.
Well, if Senator Brown is going to Okay, he'll be back, I'm sure.
Yeah, he'll be here with us.
We've got three things to clean up between now and five. And then section three simply adds the victim who is 65 years or older and who does not consent to the category of the victim of sexual abuse in the first degree. That's all. By the way, the bill was introduced at the request of the law enforcement organization.
We see the list.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are we ready on Senate Bill 357? Council has prepared language that I think she's shown most everybody on the committee while the other bills were being heard. It reads, in addition to and not in lieu of any other sentence, it may be imposed, a court may require a defendant convicted under ORS, the cruelty to animal statute, to forfeit any rights of the defendant in the animal and to repay the costs incurred in caring for each animal subject to cruel treatment up to a maximum of $1,000 per animal.
Sounds good.
Yeah. The only problem is who, costs incurred by who? Doesn't say.
Okay. Should be costs incurred by state. Should it not?
Well, be.
Not necessarily.
By the public, the law enforcement agency.
Costs
incurred in the public care of an animal.
In the public care of each animal.
Well, any costs incurred by a public agency.
Or nonprofit.
Any costs incurred by a public
I like the way it was.
I know.
Some of these are going to be private associations.
We're going to leave someone out.
Some are going to be public agencies.
I wouldn't.
All right, fine. All right.
You want just any costs incurred, Senator Hamby?
I like it.
And leave it up to the court to figure out incurred by whom.
We're going to give the court discretion. I'm sure they can handle that.
Any costs incurred in caring for each animal subject to cruel treatment up to a maximum of $1,000 per animal.
Even if the bailiff has to feed the horse.
Okay. The chair will move that amendment as a substitution for the language in the existing bill. That would have the effect of overriding Senator Gardner's earlier amendment because it would be a complete substitution.
That's fine.
Is that okay? Sure. Would the clerk call the roll on that language?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Cohen? Fry?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Hamby?
Aye.
Ingersoll? Aye.
Wyatt?
Aye. Motion carried. Would somebody like to move the bill?
I move.
Senator Brown moves the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Please call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Fry?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Hamby?
Aye.
Kinderson?
Aye.
Wire?
Aye. Motion carried. Senator Meeker will now open the public hearing on Senate Bill 410 relating to child pornography.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tony Meeker, State Senator for District 15. The care of children is a sacred trust, Mr. Chairman. The prevention of sexual exploitation of children should be a primary objective of this legislature. The victims of child pornography are completely powerless and are often betrayed by those entrusted with their care. Most distributors and processors of child pornography do not operate out of hidden motel rooms or obscure studios in big cities. Instead, they work out of their own homes. A recent federal study confirmed that there has been a steep decline in commercially available child pornography across the United States. The Government Accounting Office reports cited as factors in this decline new laws of stricter enforcement, and the recent banning of kiddie porn in Sweden and Denmark, and the tendency of jurors to convict child pornographers more readily. However, the GAO report also notes that the number of children involved in pornography has increased since 1977. And most of these children are being utilized by a close-knit network of pedophiles in homemade pornography. In a Los Angeles case, police found after cracking a kiddie porn ring that of the names on their client list, 30 to 40% had committed prior sex offenses. The underground kiddie porn market is everywhere, and people have been arrested in towns where crime never existed before. Senate Bill 410 is only a small step in cracking down on those degenerates who would abuse and betray our children, either for profit or for their pleasure. I urge your support of this bill. I know that you have the staff with the capabilities of telling you the changes in this bill over our current law. You'll note that there are some blanks in the bill, and that is to the classification of the felony. I would hope that your committee would choose to make it as high as your conscience would dictate. There's been a recent newspaper articles on things going on right here in Oregon on processing of child pornography films. And I can provide you with articles from Seattle Times and other places that show the impact of and the importance of this piece of legislation. This bill was modeled after the Texas law, which has been classified as the model law on child pornography. It's obvious to me that it can and does occur in Oregon, and we need to tighten our law to take care of it.
We have five pieces of correspondence in the file here in support, with one of them offering amendments. So there's a good deal of support. Several witnesses signed up.
We will provide you also, Mr. Chairman, with a copy of a recent editorial that appeared in the Statesman Journal in support of this.
We have it. It was just
okay, you have it. Okay, fine.
And I should tell the committee that one of the proponents of the bill offered to show us some slides today, and I said I'd rather not have them here, but if any of you would like
I was asked if I wanted to show any, and I said I don't care to see them, and if the committee wants to, I would hope it would be in a closed atmosphere and not in a public hearing.
I don't care to see them.
How old are the children in these slides or pictures?
I didn't see him. I can't tell you.
Can anybody in this room answer that question? How old are the children? Pardon? All right. Senator Meeker, old are the children in the material that you know about, that you've actually seen or are aware of?
All ages from, if you'll note in the bill, we've classified the ages 18. And the purpose of that is to equal the existing juvenile code in the state of Oregon.
Yeah, but then that really... You know, that's the reason I asked the question, because I'm wondering whether you're concerned with children, small children, or whether this is a problem involving 17-year-old girls or boys.
Well, I think my own personal opinion is that, you know, you could jack the age up to 25 and make me happy.
Well, I know, but...
Make it what age?
25. You could jack the age up to 25 and it'd make me happy, but that's not the issue. We're after child pornography. And the juvenile code is the age of 18, and that's why we chose to use it. Now, I'm sure that there can be other experts that can give you other information if you want, but I've given you my personal opinion.
Well, I'm simply trying to find out if this problem, which you have brought here by this legislation, involves 12-year-old kids or 17-year-old kids?
The answer is yes, both.
To both questions?
Yes.
And at some point in time, I would like to see what you're talking about in terms of this range of ages.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Hanby has an amendment she'd like to present at this time.
And I think in probably in for the response to Senator Frye's question, it can happen with, you know, newborns on up, where so age is really not a question. It happens to all children. I've introduced for committee's benefit a bill that in LC 1293 that I had drafted early on in the session on the request of my Washington County incest people, mental health incest workers, that were concerned about a problem that they felt was occurring within my own Washington County. The responsible actions of some photo developers to report pornographic child abusive photographs as they came into their studios. Some photo developers carried the responsibility through and informed either Children's Services or directly phoned the sheriff's department. Other photographing studios did not carry that responsibility. The request from the Mental Health Division was in turn a bill that was drafted that appears before you here today. Receiving it from council was a little late, and since Senator Meeker had his bill introduced, our conclusion was to amend Senator Meeker's bill to include photo developers. I've Xeroxed up a copy of 418-755 for your benefit to show the oral reporting system that many photo studios currently today do assume. In checking out validation for this, I took the liberty of phoning Custom Photo Service, which is one of the larger concerns here in Salem. They granted me permission, Brian Wood granted me permission to use their support on this particular amendment, although they were unable to be here today. Also, probably a larger concern working in the Portland area is a finishing lab called Jones Photo Lab on 2215 West Burnside that processes all the sandies of prints. Don Abdallah, manager of this particular lab, agreed. He has a standing policy within his shop that any negative that is developed is and found to be in any way of children or questionable aged youngsters in any way speaking to any pornographic acts of bestiality, etc., which frequently do occur, are immediately reported to law enforcement agencies. He again is most supportive of the amendment.
And you said it frequently does occur?
Yes. I could offer other testimony on Spectra. The hour is so late, however. It's an investigation currently being conducted by the FBI on a national concern that processes films, but not only do they return the prints to the individual who took the films, took the original pictures, but they retain the negatives for further sale to magazines and other companies that want them. But I won't go into that now because the hour is late.
Council points out that the hour is late, and we will work further on this.
I did stop to see Council Tom Clifford and have the sections corrected from the original bill.
The problem we're going to have to address here is, and it's going to take a little study, and I wouldn't want to try and shoot from the hip here, but on line 6 of the amendment, child has suffered abuse. Council is pointing out we may have trouble pushing that into a relating clause that says relating child pornography.
Yes. Well, maybe we've got a juvenile court bill we could use.
And Mr. Clifford's, Council Clifford's thought was by preventing child pornography and substituting children.
Relating to children. That would certainly be broad enough to cover both. Okay. I inadvertently did not get any testimony from Peter Sandrock on Senate Bill 483.
We didn't have a hearing on it yet.
Yes, I was told by some of the witnesses that they would be testifying on both, and then we didn't actually do that. So could we get Peter Sandrock to tell us a little bit about Senate Bill 483 so we will have had a hearing on it?
Thank you, Senator. For the record, Pete Sandrock, Benton County District Attorney. Senate Bill 483 would plug a hole which I think exists in our statutory scheme of sexual offenses. I have handed up to you, which I hope you have somewhere in front of you, two pages of a matrix which attempts to describe for you what I think that our sexual assault statutes try to do, beginning with the lowest level of offense, sexual abuse in the second degree, which is a Class A misdemeanor. The two driving elements of that offense are sexual contact without consent. The seriousness of the offense elevates when it becomes sexual contact by forcible compulsion. It rises to sexual abuse in the first degree, a Class C felony. If the form of the sexual contact involves intercourse, deviant intercourse, or penetration with a foreign object, then it elevates it to the Class A felony if forcible compulsion occurs. What we don't have is an intermediate offense that recognizes that as the intensity of the sexual contact increases, in other words, from mere sexual contact, hands on breasts or genitalia, for example, to a form of intercourse, deviant intercourse, or penetration with a foreign object, that ought to be the basis, a basis for elevating the seriousness of the offense. And I would propose that when you have intercourse without consent, that it be, and this is without any other aggravating factors, just intercourse, deviant intercourse, or penetration with a foreign object without consent, that then elevates it to sexual abuse in the first degree. It not only fits in with what I perceive to be the symmetry of the sexual assault code, but from a more practical viewpoint, if you prosecute someone for rape in the first degree and you prove that intercourse occurs, but you fail to prove forcible compulsion, but the jury is convinced that even though forcible compulsion didn't occur, there was lack of consent, the lesser included offense drops from the A felony all the way down to the A misdemeanor of sexual abuse in the second degree. From my viewpoint, it is more logical that we recognize that intercourse is a more aggravating factor than mere sexual contact, and it should therefore be sexual abuse in the first degree, a Class C felony.
What's the penalty for the hands on the breast example you used?
That's an A misdemeanor. I would indicate that the District Attorneys Association does support this bill. The statutory or the reference to the victim does not consent does not include a lack of capacity to consent, those situations in which a defendant lacks the capacity to consent to a sexual act are defined elsewhere in the rape code. This is, in my view, not a major change, but it is a needed change.
Thank you very much. Lynn Lubinsky and Sandy Haynes on Senate Bill 483. Senator Hendrickson and I have another meeting at 5 o'clock across town. I could see from Senator Frye's body language that he has another meeting. He had his first meeting here at 8 o'clock this morning and was working until 11 o'clock last night. And so we are going to have to leave out of here pretty soon, but we do want to hear from you. If you have to go now, Senator.
If you'll wait, I'll wait.
Okay, we can't wait long. I'm going to make an announcement about that. Well, I'll make the announcement about that now, okay? If you two ladies will just hold still here for 1 minute. This, we had too many bills probably scheduled tonight, and we've had to jump around, and I apologize. I've been getting people up here as fast as I could, interrupting people and cutting them off, and I felt very uncomfortable about this. But we have in our committee this session around 200 bills, and we're getting, last session, I was able to say that we would try and have a hearing on every bill. This session, I'm having to back down from that. There are more bills in the legislature than can, at least the Senate Judiciary Committee, than are going to be able to get a hearing this session. So I'm putting on a lot at once, and it's risking things happening like have happened tonight, where we've got probably about 9 or so people signed up on about 3 different bills that aren't going to get to testify. And I'm going to have to apologize for that. And I will stay a couple minutes after I drop the gavel in about 4 minutes, 5 minutes, to listen to you if you'll come up and tell me how you feel. Because the one thing you could do that would be worse than coming up and telling me after you stop the hearing that you're angry with me would be to go tell a lot of other people you're angry you didn't get heard. But there's an alternative to this, and that's only scheduling enough bills where we can let everybody talk, and then we'll have a whole bunch of bills up in the committee that'll never get heard, and people will be calling and calling and calling the staff, and they'll be contacting the members. This won't happen, start happening until around the 1st of June, and the newspapers start saying we're going to get out of here. Now, if we end up having to stay here into August, we'll have lots of time. But I think we're going to get out of here by the 4th of July. And so this is going to be a somewhat difficult situation, and I would appeal for your patience, but I would also invite you to come up and tell me afterward if you feel frustrated about it. Senator Hendricks.
Well, that's fine with whatever the chair wants to. I would be willing to stay a little longer if people want to make very brief testimony.
Okay. I can stay a few minutes longer, too, but I do have that meeting, and there are a bunch of people there, and they're expecting me. So go ahead. Whichever one of you'd like.
I'll be first. These two little poems were written by Marge Percy, an author. Being raped is like being hit by a truck, only afterward men ask you if you enjoyed it. Being raped is like being thrown headfirst out of the car window. Only afterward you're afraid not of cars, but of half the human race. On December 19th, 1980, I was kidnapped from a TriMet bus shelter by two men who took me to a house and raped and sexually abused me for 6 hours. One of the men had a knife and threatened me with it and used it on me. Some of the time I was tied up and I did struggle, but it did no good. After a time, I realized my struggling was making it worse for me, and I stopped. I thought it would never end, and I just gave up. I knew they were going to kill me. Since then, I have suffered from terrible guilt, not only about not fighting anymore, but doing what they made me do. Now I am...